Welcome to the Cover Brothers, where we're covering covers and looking for cover lovers. Come on in. The times are tough, man. Just getting tougher. This whole world is rough. It's just getting rougher. Cover me. Come on, baby, cover me. Well, I'm looking for a lover who will come on and cover me. Welcome back to part two of our conversation with Dr. Charles Garrett, professor of musicology at the University of Michigan, and author of the book Struggling to Define a Nation, American Music and the 20th Century. In part one, we discussed the history of cover music through classical music, blues, folk, jazz, and rock and roll. On today's episode, we finish this discussion focusing on genres such as punk, pop, hip-hop, rap, and the music of the future. We finish the episode with some rapid-fire questions and the famous Levy family game of Draft Your Band. Thanks for listening and enjoy. As, you know, the classic rock movement starts to kind of die down in the 80s and 90s, it looks like we get our first major decline in the cover world. And so, Dr. Garrett, I guess, you know, we'd love for you to talk a little bit about, you know, and again, that's not to say that there weren't some fantastic covers, like you mentioned, Whitney Houston's, you know, cover.
I'll Always Love You.
I'll Always Love You, Killing Me Softly, Hallelujah, Knock on Heaven's Door. These are all famous covers that came out in the 80s and 90s, so not to say that there weren't any, but it seems like the genres of the time, whether it was the punk genre or early rap and hip-hop or even just pop singers like Madonna, were not interested in covering, whether it was covering their contemporaries or covering the classics of the, you know, decades prior. Is there something about those genres that really made this a case?
Well, I think that it's true in the 80s in particular, that the music industry was very keen on promoting individual superstars and sort of cultivating their images, controlling the kinds of things that they would release. So the idea of a megastar and an individual who, you know, has the world at their feet, I think that that might push against the idea of covering. So that's one idea I have for that period. Another idea I have for that period, and this has to do maybe with the punk world and sort of post-punk, is well, I guess there were punk bands certainly who covered some things. I guess I should qualify that, but I think again the idea of kind of an authenticity and a not being like everyone else attitude was important for them, and might have led them not to do that.
Yeah, it's so interesting as we think about kind of the genres that we're talking about, and how much of it really does come down to kind of the like you said, the feeling that those genres create in the people who are a part of them. You know, that idea that we talked about, you know, in the last two kind of segments, jazz and rock and roll, that sharing mentality, that collaboration that we see in the jazz world, and then that component of the counterculture in rock that creates this feeling, this emotion of we should be sharing these things, and then to see it kind of melt away in punk is really just an interesting aspect of the times, really.
Yeah, well, I also just think it may have also just been, you know, in a way, just the genres were to some degree harder. I guess you may see this more with kind of more of like the 2000s and some of the kind of more modern rap and hip hop, but it seems like it was just a harder genre to cover. I mean, I can't even imagine, again, I'm talking a little bit more modern here, but I can't even imagine someone trying to cover a Kanye West song.
The idea of covering a hip hop tune, there, I can't even think of more than a handful of examples. The idea of covering hip hop is really anathema to the idea of keeping it real or representing a particular upbringing or trying to act like you are from a certain place and kind of telling a story about that experience. The whole idea of rap and covering is something that I think would be a huge challenge for you. I would encourage you to do it. But huge challenge for you to think about in terms of how in the world would you deal with the genres that don't care so much about covering.
Yeah.
And that would be at the top for sure.
Yeah, and yet that being said though, it seems like I feel like a lot of the rap world is focused a little bit on the kind of virtuosicness of how they perform their lyrics, in that, you know, who can say them faster or say them with whatever cadence they have.
Sure.
It reminds me of the jazz world a little bit, in that, you know, like you said, it was trying to kind of make your solo so unique. And yet in the jazz world, people were still trying to kind of recognize how someone played that solo and play into it and then play off of it. And yet in the rap world or in the hip hop world, we don't see anyone saying, oh, well, you know, Kanye West did his cadence like this, I think I can do that song with my cadence. It's just, it doesn't seem like it happens as much. That being said, this time period does give us kind of the start of the more modern 2010s and kind of looking to the future, which is the idea of technology taking over for the covers. So whereas someone may not be covering it a song in its kind of classic way, the ability to use remixing and sampling, or even just to have a DJ playing a song and scratching his turntable, created an entire world of what we kind of are calling like the cousin of the cover, which is remixes and sampling. So, I mean, when it comes to those kind of ways that one can cover, do you see those as equal to a cover, as any lesser than, or just any different than a cover?
I mean, they're different technically, I guess, but I think that the idea behind them is exactly the same. I haven't heard people talk about it like that, but I think it's absolutely correct. It just makes sense. I think it's a smart idea.
Yeah. Well, so now as we roll into kind of the 2010s and kind of a little bit of a look to the future, again, I think kind of like your theme of your class and of a little bit of this conversation has been, technology plays such a role, and it is so true here, as we see technology is really what is pushing a lot of the cover culture to return in the 2010s and the future. And so a few things I want to mention. The first are the television shows that we start seeing. We have the American Idol culture, which later turns into the America's Got Talent and The Voice and the Glee culture, which is literally promoting to millions of viewers this idea of covers. And whether they're amateur or professional, it brought back the cover to popular mainstream music. And so I think that was kind of a major, you know, force here. And Dr. Garrett, I'd love for you to talk just quickly about kind of the idea of how nostalgia plays into this, because I know we see that a lot with these shows, how, you know, the American Idol contestants are just kind of, you know, they want to sing the famous hits from 30 years ago.
So, I mean, one thing, one way to think about it is that television is sort of fundamentally nostalgic, and much more so than certain other media, and something that has been true on television forever. It has been part of kind of the television mantra. And, you know, going back to the 1970s, there were a lot of shows about the 1950s, for example. Some of the famous ones were Happy Days or Laverne and Shirley, the shows that that looked back. So I think that's one thing that's going on here. I think another is that there is a very large group of people interested in the same thing that people have cared about since the 19th century and earlier, which is hearing their favorite songs, being interested in hearing new voices try to master those songs. There's a great there's both familiarity and exploration kind of built into it. And I think that, you know, we might think of these TV shows as being nostalgic in one sense. They're kind of old fashioned. But we could also think of them as kind of an ongoing interest in everyday amateur music making. And I think that thinking about it in both ways is probably valuable here.
One other thing that I guess you kind of briefly mentioned, Micha, that I'm curious to get your take on, is you mentioned YouTube. So to me, like, if I were to think about the opportunity that YouTube creates.
And which, Instagram now also.
And Instagram now, I guess I don't actually have an Instagram, believe it or not, which is shocking, I know. But that opportunity that it creates to me is twofold. In one case, you can see it as, you know, potentially detrimental to artists. You know, you have amateurs not only now playing them in bars and coffee shops, but now getting, you know, millions of views and hits and in some cases becoming actually famous for their covers as total amateurs in a way that you never really would have had that opportunity in a past generation. And you could view that kind of as a potential threat to artists who are the ones making the song in the first place, or you could view it as kind of an opportunity going forward in terms of reaching audiences that you had not, you know, previously been able to reach. I'm curious to hear how you view that YouTube phenomenon.
Well, there are extremely talented and super famous megastars of this moment that have taken advantage of that, and that we might not know if there weren't those technologies available. And it's just something that I think it's just one of the big and important paths. Not exactly sure, to give one example, I'm not exactly sure whether Justin Bieber, when he was a little kid and was recording covers of R&B tunes, you know, as a way to gain YouTube popularity, I don't know if he was licensing his performances.
Right.
YouTube was a little bit more of the Wild West at that moment, so maybe he was. But if he had, it still would have been an amazing investment, right? So he's a perfect example of somebody who exploded because of social media, different opportunities, and has really perpetuated his career largely, you know, in the same ways. There was a joy to some of those early YouTube videos in the sense of some of the stuff he was singing, you know, didn't seem like his material, right? It didn't seem like it was about the experience he had growing up in suburban Canada or wherever he grew up. You know, the idea of crossing racial expectations, or the idea of a little kid singing about, you know, getting with you or whatever, those kinds of ways to play with the whole idea of what a cover is and what it could mean, and being able to do that through all the online stuff, you know, obviously created a superstar.
And yet I don't feel that it's any different than in any prior generation, other than the fact that it was just, given the technology of the time, just so much stronger and more, you know, easy for, you know, millions of people to see it. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, wouldn't an early jazz performer make his name by playing standards, and wouldn't an early folk singer make his or her name by, you know, playing the traditional folk songs from 100 years ago?
I don't think it's different fundamentally. I think it's different for the factors that I mentioned, both in terms of him seeming as if he was entering a world he hadn't been part of, and also being so young that, you know, you'd have young performers get a break. So that would certainly happen. It seems like that was something that made this particular case special.
Now, I want to move in a little bit about kind of a little more of the technology that we have right now. One thing that I think of, you know, is DAW, is digital audio workspaces that have made the amateur able to make music in their basement and put it on Spotify and be heard by, you know, millions upon millions of people. I think that's also helped, you know, the whole cover you know, world. And something I heard by Ted Gioia on a podcast I just listened to with Conversations with Tyler, mentioned something about how, you know, whenever we feel that we're in a lull, technology has always kind of seemed to be the thing that can really push us over and, you know, into a new kind of peak of music, not necessarily in terms of covers, but Dr. Garrett, I mean, I felt like there, you know, like we said, there was a little bit of a lull, whether it was in the 80s, 90s, whether it, you know, bled into the early 2000s. I feel like we're about to start seeing a real peak into collaborative music, whether it turns into covers or just new forms of genres and new styles. In your kind of, you know, experience, is there something that we're working with right now or some new technology that you think is going to be the new thing?
Well, there are lots of new technologies that people are exploring. People are starting to, for example, try out recording and music making procedures in virtual reality. It hasn't been developed as much as I expect it will be. Another thing that's interesting has to do with some developments and, I guess we could say, plugins for digital audio workstations that will allow performers to take advantage of different kinds of artificial intelligence. And this could mean a few things. It could mean, as we have had for decades now, it could mean things like auto-tuning and other ways in which artificially intelligent software will help polish things or help create different kinds of effects. But AI is also doing some things for artists where artists can ask the AI agent in a digital audio workstation or with Pro Tools or with Ableton Live can ask the program basically to supply information. So this is, I think, a little bit counter to covers in the sense that it's a procedure where artists can basically get extra computer input, especially when they're stuck, and then try to figure out what to do with that information. But you can also see some of the AI developments as being ways in which to transform existing material. And I'll give you one specific way that people have tested, but again, for copyright reasons, there's some contention about what to do. So one thing that the AI software programs allow, the larger software companies allow, or are able to do is take a lot of input. And then to create music based on that input. So let's say you take the catalog of the Birds, and you take all the Bird songs and you put them into the blender, and then you ask the AI software to create a Birds-like song based on some procedures that happen in Bird songs. Well, technically that's possible. We can do that right now. And the results are mixed. They're getting better, I think, but they're mixed. But in some ways, that's kind of like getting a cover of the Birds, not getting a cover of one song, but just sort of getting an idea of this is a song that fits the Birds. The reason that we haven't heard more about this is because people are arguing about, one, are the aesthetic results any good? Like, does this actually... would anybody want to listen to this? And then second, who gets the money? If you take the Bird songs and you create an AI-related song from their music, is that a Bird song? Right. Is that a computer programmer song? Is that the song of the person working at the digital audio workstation who decides to churn all this into their own creation? So those kinds of things are getting... they're getting talked about. They will get resolved. They'll probably get resolved in the courts when somebody actually wants to do that. But I know of popular musicians who have specifically moved away from using copyrighted tunes as the basis for some kind of AI-related music making because they don't want to later get dragged into court or try to argue with lawyers about whether their music is under somebody else's control. So there are musicians who, for example, have taken non-copyrighted music from the 19th century or 18th century. They've taken melodies from way back when, and they've used that in order to create new music to try to skirt around some of these copyright issues. So it's quite an interesting phenomenon. I can't recommend any of the songs as being amazing, but I can see it as something that is, it's coming.
Wow. That's very interesting. I mean, I had no idea that that was coming. So it seems like, you know, this kind of decade or two have been really a peak for amateur cover performance. And yet and as you said, you know, as, you know, technology will change, we'll see what that can do in the future. But the one thing we haven't seen still in these decades has been the real, the superstars of the world still covering the way that maybe they had in other genres and in other decades. I mean, besides for, you know, some occasional live Ed Sheeran performance covers of some of his contemporaries, we don't really see, you know, the modern stars of today covering, whether it is their contemporaries of the time or covering kind of older music. Do you think, as we're starting to see maybe a bright future for the amateur cover world, do you think at one point, you know, in the near future, we will start to see more of a professional cover world kind of being revitalized?
You know, I hope so. I think it speaks a bit to how formulaic some artists are in terms of how they present shows and what they choose to perform. I think there's just so much control and so much planning that goes into the intricacies of a lot of these shows that performers don't necessarily do things on the fly, at least for big audiences. And I think it's too bad. I mean, I think it's great in terms of, you know, give the people what they want, and that's maybe what they want. But the idea of performers exploring different paths, I would love to see a bit more of a return to that. Although I will say, if I went to see a big name performer and they played covers of all their favorite stuff that's going on at the moment, I'd probably be really upset. So, you know, I have a theoretical attitude toward this, but in practice, if they don't play the hits that drew me to them, I'd probably be bummed, as if I had seen, you know, I'd seen the wrong show.
Well, that's I think that's certainly something that we share the same sentiment of wanting, yeah, to see more of those covers. I guess also kind of qualified with the notion that if you're paying whatever it is, you know, $180 to see somebody at MSG, you're maybe hoping that they play the songs that you came there for.
That being said, though, yeah, we saw Tedeschi Trucks in Red Rocks, as our fans know, because we've already mentioned on the show, and they must have played. I mean, I think their set was 50% covers.
Yeah, they played a lot of great covers, but we loved it. Well, look, you know, Professor Garrett, it's been really interesting and really helpful to hear kind of your view of the world of covers and that side of the music industry through so many decades. It's been certainly eye-opening to me. I'm sure you, even though you took his class, it probably similar reaction.
Oh, yeah.
But before we go, before we let you go, I guess, we wanted to do a quick rapid fire round, some fun questions that we had for you that we were curious about to get your take on. So I'll start it off. Do you remember the first cover you ever heard and realized that it was a cover?
Yeah, I do. I'm just trying to remember the name.
You can also see it.
It was a Joe Cocker cover of a Beatles song, the ballad.
With a little help from a friend.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
Yeah. That's a great one.
All right, go ahead.
We've yet to do that one on the show, but it's coming.
It's on its way.
So have you seen any tribute bands or any cover or any, like, you know, very well known cover bands?
I've never seen in person a tribute band, but I have seen bands that have turned into a tribute band or a cover band for an evening, and that's been really fun. But, and I knew it was coming. So the most obvious is Yo La Tengo, Hoboken indie rock band. Very fond of covers, and also have released albums of covers. And the interesting thing and different thing, we haven't talked about this much. They're very they have their way. They have their own way, and they're very fond of different covers that have meant things to them. But they're often tunes that only real aficionados know. So when I was in the audience, I would recognize a few things that they were playing and maybe others that they'd recorded and I thought of as their tunes. But it was a different kind of cover experience. It was kind of like a midnight college DJ playing obscure covers of songs you never even knew were covers. So it was kind of a fun and different experience.
That sounds like a
lot
of fun.
Isn't that the best when you hear a song and you say, oh, I love that song by this performer, only to find out
it's not them.
That they're the 800th person to cover it. And it makes me upset also because I had a chance to see Yo La Tengo. They were opening for someone, and I forget who it was, and I just, missed the opener.
Yeah.
Never missed the opener.
Never missed the opener. Okay, I've got another one. What is your favorite cover, meaning the actual cover itself is your favorite? Which one of those is your favorite of your entire musical catalog?
That's a hard one.
I
I really love the Talking Heads Take Me to the River. And I love Al Green more than I love Talking Heads.
Right.
But I knew that song first. I knew people who loved it. I knew it when the band was becoming really popular. I was in New York at the time. I saw them. I saw them do that on Stop Making Sense. And I could never go back to Al Green's version as much as I love him.
That's great.
Yeah, I think that is the point when a cover becomes the cover, is when you can't go back to the original and hear it as the original. I've definitely experienced that. Okay, Dr. Garrett, are you a Paul or a John guy?
Oh, Ringo.
a man after my own heart.
I think I love John's attitude and philosophy and example. But went to visit both of their homes in Liverpool in a trip a couple years ago. Really remarkable. A couple of their childhood homes basically are museums now in Liverpool. And just amazing to see the kind of, middle class little abodes that they were in when they produced a lot of those early songs. It's just mind-blowing. So if you ever get a chance to go to Liverpool and see their homes, completely worth it.
That's great. That's on the bucket list, I would guess. I'll do one more, and then maybe you can throw Dr. Garrett the last one. From the early part of our conversation, you play three instruments, it sounds like. If you had to cover a song right now, you can choose whichever instrument you feel most comfortable covering it on, but what song would you cover if you yourself could play one, for a large audience, large enough that you might have to get the licensing, perhaps?
Oh, obviously I would play Stairway to Heaven on my electric guitar, which I can't actually play. But if I could do one thing that is kind of a classic music thing to do for a pop music person, that would be it.
Well, good. It's better to do it there than in a Sam Ash.
I was going
to
say,
if you do it in Sam Ash, someone will yell at you.
Yeah, tell all the Sam Ash listeners to close their ears. I actually had an interesting question. We play this game, Judah and I. It's called Choose Your Band. So if you had to create, a 4 or 5-piece band or a 3-piece band, whatever, and it can be any genre you'd like. But here's the rule. You can only choose one musician for each instrument. So you can make a guitar, bass, piano, drum band. You can make a jazz quartet or whatever you'd like. Who would those musicians be? Oh, and the other rule is you can only have one musician from a group, so you can't choose Robert Plant and Jimmy Page to be your lead singer and guitarist, because then we all would. So if you had to choose making your own band, who would you choose throughout history?
That's a good question. I'm going to incorporate into some of my classes. It's a good icebreaker.
We want the copyright licensing on that, though, Doctor.
I know a lot about copyright and also how to skirt it at times. Let's see, who would I want? So I'd want Corinne Tucker, the lead singer of Sleater-Kinney.
Oh, wow.
She has kind of a boisterous and she has a boisterous voice. I'll just put it that way. I'd want Neil Peart from Rush because they were the first band I ever saw, and because he was great and died last year or maybe the year before.
Yeah.
I'll go with Jimmy Page on guitar because how can you go wrong?
Exactly.
That's a good answer. How could you go wrong?
Exactly. Dr. Garrett, really, really appreciate you being on the show and your wisdom and taking us through the, you know, almost, what, I think 100, maybe 100, over,
I think
over,
we covered
100,
over 100 years,
100
of,
years
musical
of
musical history in an hour
more.
And a half. That's pretty
got,
good.
I think we got through more than 100. So, you know, we really appreciate it. We know our listeners are going to, you know, really like to kind of get a firm grasp of, you know, where the music that we've been talking about is coming from, why we care so much about it, you know, why we spend, 40 minutes every once in a while just, you know, talking about covers, because it's meaningful. So, Dr. Garrett, thank you so much.
Thanks for your time.
To any, you know, University of Michigan people listening, I definitely recommend Dr. Garrett's class. It was one of my favorite classes at Michigan. For any non-Michigan people, I recommend reading his book so that you can get
a transfer
sense.
To Michigan.
Or just transfer to Michigan. What are you doing at this point? Just transfer to Michigan. Do it virtual.
We Dr. do Garrett. Need students.
That's true.
Doctor, thanks for your time, and we hope to catch you on another podcast at some time later on.
Happy to do it today, happy to return someday. So thank you so much for having us, and it's really great for me to be in touch with former students and also to know that you still care about music. It's great. So thank you.
We certainly do.
Of course, we always do. All right, signing off.
Take care.